Today's podcast is sponsored by the people at Aura.com. Now, Aura offers identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, a VPN, password management, and antivirus software all in one easy-to-use app. This means that if your online accounts or passwords are leaked online, you'll be alerted quickly, which means that you can be secure from hackers, scammers, and noisy advertising companies. The narcissists are everywhere. Literally, a friend of mine signed up and Aura found his passwords 9 times on the dark web. So go to Aura.com/Dr. Carter. That's Aura.com/Dr. Carter. And use my link and you'll receive a free 14-day trial. And if you continue, then you'll be able to save an additional 40% off all plans. So thanks to the people at Aura.com for sponsoring this episode.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Surviving Narcissism Podcast. This is Michaela, the program director, and I would like to start this episode with a short introduction. For those of you new to this podcast, Surviving Narcissism is the product of many years of work done by Dr. Les Carter. Dr. Carter is a best-selling author and therapist with more than 40 years of experience, specializing in anger management and narcissistic personality disorder. This week, Dr. C's topic will be Breaking Free from a Narcissist, featuring Dr. Romani.
Well, Team Healthy, I've got a very special program for us here today, and this is going to be somebody that's going to need next to no introduction for the rest of you. I have Dr. Romani Devasula. Okay, before I get into the introduction here, Dr. Romani, thank you so much for being a part of the Surviving Narcissism podcast and YouTube channel. So I'm thrilled to have you with me here today.
I'm thrilled to be here. I think that people have heard both of our voices, so it's nice to have both of our voices together in one place. So,
well,
thank you so
much. And you and I were noticing, I get comments that say, well, Dr. C, yeah. I listen to you and Dr. Romani, and I know you get the same thing in reverse.
I do. Yeah.
We're on the same team, all right? And the whole goal is let's see if we can help people figure this out. Okay, just for a sense of a little bio here, now you grew up on the East Coast, right?
I did.
And then you're out in the LA area. You came there and completed your PhD at UCLA. You've had a private practice. You've been a university professor. Obviously, you have your YouTube presence. You've been on many media outlets, Today Show, Good Morning America. You're best-selling author. So it kind of says that you're in demand and you've been doing something right for quite some time now. I do want to ask just because I know I get this question quite a bit, but I want to hear your thoughts on this too. How did you get into the topic of narcissism as a go-to focal point in your profession?
Three pathways, I would say. And you would think it was all my personal story, and it really wasn't. It was research. I was overseeing different research projects, and in one of them, they were being conducted in community clinics. And one thing that the student research assistants were bringing up, they'd come back quite frustrated to, I sort of ran the main lab, and they'd say, how can these people be so mean and rude? And they were speaking about entitlement, the kind of stuff you might see in a clinic. And then as I sat with their complaints, I thought, ooh, it's interesting. Probably about 5 to 10% of the patients in these community clinics are demanding 50 to 60% of the personnel resources. And that led me to want to then dig into the literature. Does anyone ever look at personality and how that affects health behaviors, engaging with healthcare? And the answer to that was no. So that started a long period of funded research. At the same time, I also had a small private practice. And in there, I found people kept kind of coming in, and the issue they were bringing in, obviously the bells and whistles were different, but the core was very much these sort of invalidating, dehumanizing, and deeply confusing relationships. And I almost felt there were times something, didn't I just say that at 2 o'clock to the 2 o'clock client? I thought, wow, there's a lot of similarity. Again, nothing I found that was really solid in the literature. There were folks out there like Lundy Bancroft who were really talking about like these sort of angry men in relationships, but I still didn't feel that captured the whole spectrum. I felt that Bancroft was talking more about the severe end of the spectrum. There were a lot of people where nobody was getting beaten up, but there was this middle ground that wasn't getting captured. Then the third piece was nobody in mental health is talking about this. And when I started talking about it in small groups, people would, sort of like, you shouldn't say that. You shouldn't talk about that. And I thought, wait a minute. If we don't talk about this, how are we contextualizing what's happening to people in these relationships? And I realized mental health, the world of mental health, psychology, call it what you will, was willing to ignore this situation. I think narcissistic clients are a client group that traditionally many therapists have said, I'm not going to take that client. So it almost created this convenient unseeingness within the field. I don't have to see that because I'm not seeing these clients. And I'd imagine there was a handful of practitioners that took them on. But at the end of the day, what was being missed was what was happening to folks in these particular relationships. And I've talked less with many a couple's therapists who said, I don't ascribe to the narcissism model. I think it's communication issues. And I thought, how terrible, because these people were being blamed. And then interestingly, as I did my own deep dive in my own therapy, you know, I'd been in for years, was it was only then I started connecting the dots on lived experience for myself. And I recognized how this had showed up as a legacy issue, how, you know, in family issues, how it showed up in workplace issues, how it had shown up in educational settings, and how it had showed up in friendships and intimate relationships. And it was an aha moment, because it wasn't like I ran screaming away from all these people. But once I put a frame on it, I really alleviated so much self-blame. I carried the neuroses with me to this day, something I talk to survivors about. It doesn't just go away. But that holistic picture sort of rounded the circle. Ironically, it was the lived experience that was the last thing I figured out.
Well, we're humans too, aren't we? Yeah. Okay. Now I want to talk with you today about the whole notion of people that are looking to break free from narcissism. And I know that's kind of a broad kind of thing, but it's going to allow us to speak into this issue. All right. As you have zeroed in on this whole topic of narcissism, and I know I have about 7, 8, 9 primary characteristics that I watch for that tell me if a person is inside that narcissistic pattern or not. But, and I know you have similar kinds of thoughts there. If you had to zero in on one primary element that makes narcissism so toxic, I know there are many, but at the top of the list, what would you put there? What is it about narcissists that are so difficult and toxic?
I'm going to give you two answers to that question. I'm going to say within the narcissistic person themselves, it's the lack of self-awareness. We see a person who's so high functioning in the world. Narcissistic people on average make more money. They're more likely to be represented in leadership. These are not people who are sort of not, and some of them don't drag themselves out of bed, but by and large, these are people who are sort of at the top of their game. It's the lack of self-awareness, which obviously then drives all those other things like lack of empathy and all of that. But that piece, so that when you try to talk to them, you get into all the patterns, the blame shifting, the manipulation, all the things that make it a problem. But I do have to say it's that someone so smart actually is not able to reflect on how they're affecting another person. And then on the whole cascade of effects. That's sort of answer number one. I'd have to say that the second answer that I want to give to that is the piece about it's the hot, cold, black, white, good mask, bad mask. That piece to me is so nefarious because it confuses survivors. If these people were terrible all the time, bad from front to back, screaming, shouting, yelling, abuse, this would be easy. But, and so it's the alternation, and obviously that's what fuels the trauma bondedness, and that fuels all of the problems in the relationship. And the person says, I feel guilty. We had a nice weekend. They were so good with the kids. They sacrificed so much. They were so happy at my graduation. And then peppered in that is the day-to-day-to-day manipulation, gaslighting, invalidation, raging. And that sense of almost the chase that a person is on in these relationships, like what is happening? It's almost like one of those movies where somebody's trying to, you know, find a murderer and they've got all the pictures and the strings on the wall. And that's what these survivors are doing. And because of that, it's not as simple as this person treats me badly, I'm out of here. And that actually really creates a war inside of survivors. To me, that's sort of the interactional element of that, that's the worst, but it's, to me, it's the lack of self-awareness in somebody.
Well, and actually, as you're speaking there, the term that comes to my mind is intermittent reinforcement. Did you have to do the Skinner boxes like I did way back when in the days where you teach the rat all these different tricks?
I was not. Yeah, that was a little before my time. We learned about them in school, and I never would have touched a rat anyhow. So, but again, you bring it up, right? It's the slot machine, and that's what I say. These relationships are slot machines, and you know, if slot machines paid out on every fifth pull, we wouldn't even play them. But if they paid out on every pull, it's the idea that you might get the big payout. I agree, it is intermittent reinforcement. But it's what happens in between those reinforcements is, but I could get a jackpot. And then, you know, and but I got $50 an hour ago. You've now spent $300, but you're not thinking about that. And so that to me is what makes it so interpersonally terrible. But that lack of self-awareness in someone who is able to be so nice to their boss, flirtatious with the lady at the gym, and so horribly cruel to a partner, that's the piece, and not even see the difference between those things.
Well, I'm a bit more, cynical when I hear something like that. It's almost as though they kind of know what they're doing. And the reason I say that is because they can turn it on and turn it off depending on who's in front of them.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And that's an important one, Les, because I think that what often happens, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot from survivors, what I hear from survivors all the time is maybe they can't help it. And then we start getting into the thickets. And I'd be curious to hear how much of this you've heard. I'm a big believer that narcissism is solely and completely a personality style. I actually don't believe in narcissistic personality disorder. And when I say I don't believe in it, I recognize it's an entity in the DSM. Right. But I think that the codifying of it has taken this conversation about these really toxic interpersonal patterns and turned it into this semantic battle about don't diagnose people you haven't known. Well, if it's a diagnosis, it means then they can't help it, yada, yada, yada. And what it's done is it's shamed a lot of survivors, some who are even being hit with accusations of being ableist, which is not at all what they were doing. They were speaking about a pattern. And I have a personality, you have a personality, those personalities can be named. Narcissism is just yet another personality. And while people say, well, that's not a very nice personality, I said, maybe so, but if you'd like to compare bank balances, trust you me, they're doing just fine. And so that's a lot of the struggle is when I try to explain to people, maybe they can't help it. I said, of course they can help it, because your narcissistic mother called you. And when she called you in the car, she asked you, is anyone else in the car, with a sweet voice. And when you said, I'm alone, then she let it rip because she didn't want an audience to her tantrum. She knew that that behavior wasn't okay. She didn't want other people to hear it. And she knew to turn it off, because if someone else was around, she wouldn't have done it.
And but then going back to your lack of self-awareness, when you say, hey, can we take a look at what's going on here? They can't access that kind of thinking. Even though there's obvious choice that's involved, they still, they're too afraid to go into that introspective mode and say, well, let me tell you where this originated. And let me explain to you, they can't do that. It's just not in their makeup to do so.
And again, but I would also argue it to be, I mean, I agree that there's shame and there's unconscious processes around shame. Absolutely. Yes. And they're not they're not accessing those. But there's also contempt for the process, right? I don't, you know, I'm sure you've worked with narcissistic clients in your practice. I've worked with many in my time and still consult on with some clients. And it's as soon as I try to veer the car in that direction, it's, you know, basically they view the shrink, they view the therapy as a place to solve a problem, no different than going to their accountant and trying to get a tax issue resolved. And once they get the issue, whatever the problem is, you know, how come my girlfriend isn't calling me back or something, you know, it's usually superficial nonsense. Once they get that worked out, as it were, they feel their ego is, you know, is strong again. They feel safe and secure. There is no interest, whether that's capability, whether that's an unconscious battle, whether that's the fear of crumbling with the ego.
Either way, there it is.
All of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So when a person is engaging with that narcissist and you know, the narcissist is bringing all their toxicity to you, what is it that you would say the narcissist is looking for in that other person that kind of gives them the green light, that makes them think, okay, this is somebody I can mess with. This is somebody I can do my number on. What do they see in other individuals that makes them think, oh, I'm onto it?
Here's where I'm gonna push back a little bit less. I don't think that the narcissist thinks they're doing a number on anyone. I really don't. I think that they see in another person, they see supply, right? Do I like your supply? And that supply could come from anything, from attractiveness to connections to status you bring to the car you drive to the sex you can give them to the introduction you can make or to the forgiveness you bring, because then they're like, oh, well, I can do anything. You know, if I do this, they're going to let me get away with it. So it's almost like this is a low friction relationship. I think that for me, that the model of, because if they had self, it's that lack of self-awareness again. If they had self-awareness, they'd kind of say, oh, I'm a kind of a shady player. I almost view that more in the realm of psychopathy. The calculating person who says, I just need to get in there and mess with this person a little bit. I'm going to get what I need from them. That calculating quality, I actually don't think the narcissists are vibing at that level. I really do think that they are playing a game. It's almost like a dog. Like you give the dog food, the dog's going to eat the food. Cat's a little bit more like, I'm not hungry, I'm good. But the dogs are going to eat the food. And so the narcissist wants supply. And I think that they're always looking for supply. It could just be something as simple as a compliment. Once they find the person who's giving them the supply they want, they'll decide they'll keep them around. And then whatever social pressures there are, for example, there's often a pressure in our culture to get married and have a family because that looks societally normative or good. They'll want that window dressing, but they sure as heck don't want to be a spouse and all the heavy lifting that a marriage really is of being present and mutual and regard and loving and compassionate and respectful. They're not interested in that piece. They're interested in just sort of, it's almost like having the car in the garage, the milk in the fridge and the wife in the bed. I mean, it's all pieces. Yeah. I don't think they're that calculating. I actually think that they see what they need and they get it. It's like when I go to the grocery store, I don't buy the thing I don't need.
Yeah, well, and one of the things I tell folks, you need to remind yourself, you know, when they say, what did I do? You need to remind yourself, well, you showed up.
Yeah, that's it. At the right time with the right stuff. That's my point about the grocery store. The grocery store has the thousands of items in it. You know, I went in there looking for mustard. I'm walking out with mustard. So the person who is looking for sex is going to look for a person they're attracted to. Person who's looking for somebody who's looking for a status, for example, may then approach someone, may not be attractive to them, but has that status. They might be very clear on what that supply looks like, but it is ultimately supply. And that it's very simple. You were there. And for whatever reason, you represented the thing they needed. You were the gallon of milk they needed from the store at that time. Anyone else who was a gallon of milk would have been in those crosshairs.
Yep. Now, suppose a person says, this isn't working for me. This person keeps coming at me with all of this toxicity that Dr. Romney is describing here. And I'm not getting a good benefit out of this. I got to get away from this. What would you say is going to be the, let's just call it step number one, that they're going to have to get in their mind so that they can start making their bona fide efforts to break free and claim who they are? How does it start?
I'd say number one, do not get caught, because I think the ideation that catches people is the idea that the narcissistic person is going to change. I'm going to leave, they're going to change. I'm going to leave, they're going to therapy. I'm going to leave, they're going to change for the next person. They're not going to change. So let's just, you know, it's I always tell people, it's like Chicago. Oh, this is the year. If I move from Chicago this February, this is the year February is going to be warm. Chicago's never going to be warm in February. So if you don't like the winter, February is a perfectly good time to leave. And so it's that number one is the unchangeability. And then I would say number two is to really become well-versed in what we call post-separation abuse. Post-separation abuse tends to show up a bit more with the more severe narcissistic personalities. However, it may not be quite stalking and smear campaigns or legal stuff, But even in the mid-level, narcissistic people do not like to be left. So the next thing I would tell people to prepare for is to be hoovered, that they are not, they don't like not being in control. The being in control keeps their shame at bay. It reminds them that they're dominant. So if they lose that control by you leaving, they're going to get that control back, even if it is just to lure you in for another week so they can be the one to break up with you. It is, they really need to be in control of that narrative. And so I tell folks, be prepared for that. Some people, they try to play with fire and say, well, if I end it with them, then they're going to try to win me over and I'm going to feel really powerful. I'm like, nah, they're holding their queen back on this chessboard. Like, they're going to get you. So if you want out, get out. Be prepared that there's going to be attempts to pull you back in. They're going to alternate between trying to seduce you and then criticizing you and telling you the worst person. That back and forth, the same kind of trauma bonded mess you were in initially, is going to play out in the post separation period. And it also might get a little dark. They may be stalky. They may say inappropriate things about you on social media. They may turn other people against you. Things may happen that feel really sad and painful and uncomfortable and all of that. So I think it's to be really prepared for what that is. And above all else, I think a lot of people say, I've broken up with a narcissistic toxic relationship. Now I'm going to be fine. It depends how deep in the cave you went, but that relationship stole some of your autonomy and some of your identity, your individual. Yeah,
well, in fact, the way I put it is in its more extreme forms, the narcissist wants to empty you of you. Yeah. Fill you with themselves.
Correct. Exactly. That's smart. I love how you put that. I think that's great because that's what they try to do. So the getting out process is as much getting away from the relationship as it is working on you, understanding what happened. Again, what historical things might have happened in your life that might have created a vulnerability. Maybe you just didn't know. And I'll often tell people there needs to be a period of being alone. Like, don't just throw yourself in another relationship. Take a minute. Like, figure, you know, get acquainted with you again.
Yeah. What I'm hearing you say also is just, you need to know who this person is. Knowledge is power.
Yes.
And the more you're able to have your awareness, despite their lack of awareness, then it reminds you that they're going to be predictable in their comeback. And so you have to remind yourself, that's just what they are, but I've got to find out who I'm going to be. I'd like for you to be aware of my video courses. One is entitled Ready, Set, Connect. Now, narcissists are quite capable of throwing you off balance, so this course keeps you focused on the skills and the mindset that are necessary for positive connections. And inside the course, we have various modules that, and inside each module are lessons, and each lesson contains a video, written documents, and then questions that go along with it. We'll discuss things like how to have good conflict resolution skills, building empathy, how to be the authentic self that you need to be. If you're interested in enrolling, you can go to our website, survivingnarcissism.tv, click the link for courses. You'll find Ready, Set, Connect there, as well as the others. I hope that you would find them to be quite helpful.
And now back to Surviving Narcissism with Dr. Carter.
Now, what do you suppose it is with the narcissist that how they are able to rationalize within their mind why it's so necessary to control another human being? How do they get to that place?
It's so interesting because, you know, so many people are traumatized by narcissistic relationships. They don't understand how fractured the internal workings of narcissistic people are, right? So narcissistic people frequently perceive threat in their environment. They have what's called a hostile attribution bias, which is a fancy way of saying they're really thin skinned and they're constantly thinking there's threats around. So
paranoia.
It's a low grade non-delusional paranoia. Exactly. And so what's happening with that is, in order that they're always justifying and rationalizing in, because that becomes one more protection. They can't be the bad one because there's two interesting processes happening in narcissism. Not only is it the protection of ego and the sort of the smushing down of that shame response, but it's also that need to be perceived as good. This is where, again, narcissism veers away from psychopathy. Psychopaths really aren't invested in the idea of being viewed as good. They want to be viewed as good if it's a means to an end, right? Pretending to be a humanitarian, but harming lots of people. But it's not really that they care that people think they're good. It's just that perception gives them the track in to exploit people.
It's their latest manipulation ploy.
Correct. But narcissistic people need to be viewed as good. And when they're not, for example, if they're the center of a scandal, they're caught out in an infidelity and everyone in their community or group knows that they did that. That is actually crushing for them. And it can really lead to narcissistic injury, where we can often see that narcissistic depression, where the loss of face happens in such a public way that they lose a lot of cred. And it's very, very difficult for them to recover from that. So the rationalization and justification allows them to maintain the false self. It's not because it's really not who they are. You know, it's like the false self is right, that they're right. good.
I'm tracking with you all the way.
Yes, to maintain this sense of self of, I'm a great guy. I'm a great gal. I'm such a giving person. I'm a wonderful mother. You know, that kind of identity gets to maintain. Well, that happened because, and I did this because, and this was your fault because, and the narrative system they've created is so complicated that they actually believe their own mythology. I've seen this happen in couples therapy with narcissistic people over and over again, that over time, the story that's being told, I'm like, this is a pure fiction, but I realize that this is how they get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, well, and you know, they'll say things like, you'll never find a friend as good as me, or right. You know, I'm the most helpful or the most understanding mm-hmm. person you've ever met. Mm-hmm. And they're talking to themselves as much as yep. they're lying to yep. themselves yep. as much as they are to you. They're trying to convince themselves. Okay, I want to go back. You mentioned that when a person gets to the point of saying, I need to get away from this, and you start developing this awareness and you see what's going on and you think, you know, I can do better. I'm going to do better. When you start making some of the adjustments that we encourage people to go toward, what is what predictable blowback should we prepare for? What can we expect that the narcissist is going to do? You mentioned the term hoovering, and by the way, for those who are not aware of that, that's you know, reference to the vacuum cleaner.
Vacuuming, yeah.
Just pull them right back in. But yeah. What kind of blowback would you say is most common that we need to watch out for?
Like I said, it's that whole constellation of post-separation abuse. It could be, again, in the most severe cases, it could be stalking, in the sense of they're electronically stalking you, they're surveilling you. Listen, if it's a more malignant case, you want to have your house swept for devices. You want to get your car swept for devices. You want to check your iPhone, make sure there's not an AirTag in your stuff. I mean, they may really, really be keeping tabs on you. They may get false Instagram accounts to follow your whereabouts, or false Facebook accounts and what you're up to, what you're doing. There might even be malware on your computer. That's more extreme, but this idea of tech abuse is very real in these narcissistic relationships. They might even have given you a phone as a gift during the course of your relationship and have paid the bill. Get rid of it. Get a new phone on your own account. I mean, so these are little tweaks you can make, especially if you feel like they know things they shouldn't know. Again, that's a more severe end. Other things you might expect is that they will get to people that you had as mutual friends or family and sell a version of the story of your relationship, which isn't true. That paints them, the narcissistic person, as the victim, and you as the offender, and you as the problem. And so all of that can really, it can leave you unsettled. And it can also leave you feeling as though you're quickly losing a social support network that you once thought was you had and that you believed in and that you trusted. This is going to sound like a strange one to say, Les, is that some people will actually find themselves missing the narcissistic person. A therapist I once worked with very wisely said to me, narcissistic people are almost like a full-time job when they're in your life. So they keep you busy. How can I please them? How can I win them over? How can I figure out what they're thinking? Ruminate, ruminate, ruminate. And they take up so much mental real estate that once they're gone, you're like, do I miss them? Do I miss, like, they were kind of a hobby. There were a lot to do. Yeah. But genuinely, I can't also devalue the real feelings people have for someone. Like, listen, I was with this person for a long time, or even the year we were together was great. I actually miss them. I miss the activities we did together. So there can be a missing, and that can be confusing. When I work with clients, I have to say, you can miss someone and it can also be an unhealthy relationship. I think people say, well, I missed them, so maybe I made a mistake. And then if they're hoovered saying, oh, here's my chance, I can get back in, I think maybe I was wrong. And it's to understand that some very different things can be true in these relationships. So I think a lot of those things take people by surprise, like how, and again, that hoovering can often surprise them. And so maybe 2 or 3 months in, you're feeling stronger. Memory has a tendency to fade a bit. Two, three, four, 5 months out, especially let's say you are feeling lonely, if it was a romantic relationship and there were some good times. And now that narcissistic person who love bombed and charmed the heck out of you the first time, they haven't lost that skill set. Yeah. So you're sitting home, it's a Saturday night, you might be hanging out alone. Hey, just been thinking of you. And then the whole text exchange starts again. And here you are having those old familiar feelings. And now the survivor is starting to justify, well, maybe it will be different this time. And there's all the dynamics like future faking. And they said they've changed. And they said this time this is going to happen. And this time that's going to happen. And so you may be entering a precarious territory. As a therapist who works in this area, one thing I do tell clients is, if you need to go back in, go back in. It is not my job to tell you not to. I think that it's all about, I want survivors to always feel that sense of choice and that the therapist is a soft place to land. Not that the therapist is scolding. What are you doing? They're hoovering you.
Well, you don't need to be the next person to try to control.
No, exactly. So our spaces as you know, as therapists supporting people is to say, hey, I'm here. And you can process it. And I'm like, you know what I tell them often? Prove me wrong. You know, please. Or recognize that there's some things about you that may have changed. Maybe yeah. Once you plant your flag and you're being yourself, your true self, and showing up as your true self. And they're like, no, 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 you have to do it my way. And you say, no, 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 I'm not. The relationship may actually come to a different end because you're not relenting to what they needed. I think that's a win.
Yeah, you know, you were talking there about how these relationships don't always close quickly and easily. One of the things that I find is the narcissist, like you say, they crave your supply that you offer yeah. them. Yeah. They're gonna sometimes they'll make the promise. I promise I'll be different, or they may give some pseudo empathy. Often that's not the case, but nonetheless. Many people will ask the question, well, if I put my foot down, if I say I'm not going to go along with this anymore, could I expect that narcissist is actually going to listen to me, coordinate with me, and make the adjustments so that we can go our merry way down the road? Is that a very likely outcome, or is that just a pipe dream? What's your experience there?
That the narcissistic person will make their adjustments so you can go down the road together?
Right.
Yeah, here's the thing. It is, pipe dream feels strong to me. I think it's a bit unicorn-y, right? What I say to folks that one of the, you know, the advantage that a lot of narcissistic people have is time, right? They tend to push the accelerator on a new relationship. So you feel rushed and then what you've now reshaped your life around this person, right? I do think that unless a person who is narcissistic, is in therapy with one hell of a therapist. I'm a sort of a side note. Narcissism has so many different etiologies. Les, we know that there's different origins to narcissism. It can be trauma. It can be neglect. It can be early life chaos. It can be sort of societal cultural privilege stuff.
Yeah. It can also be entitlement angle. You know, yeah.
It can be the crown prince, princess sort of spoiled, you know, child overindulge, right? Here's one thing I'm seeing anecdotally is that the clients who have more of a traumatic origin to their narcissistic style, if they get into really good trauma-informed therapy, whatever that looks like, EMDR, somatic awareness, but the real trauma work, some of those clients are making micro changes. I still don't think enough to create a healthy relationship, but I'm not having a relationship with them. I feel like the trauma becomes an interesting treatment target where you might be able to shift some of that. Because again, some narcissistic patterns have a post-traumatic feel to them. A lot of the other patterns, I don't think you can get there. And I still think with the vast majority of post-traumatic narcissism, you're not going to get there either. But all of that said, I do think that the odds are not in your favor. The Yeah. probability is very low. And here's what I leave a lot of survivors with, because it would be arrogant for either you or I to say, this is never going to get better. It's always going to be terrible. If you go back, you're making a mistake. That's easy. But some people will say, you know what? I recognize that, yeah, they've made enough shifts in A, B, and C that I can live with it. D, E, and F are still terrible. These things are still not going well. I've made adjustments in myself. I remember talking with one couple where the woman said, we split up, all that. And then when we got back together, we kept separate residences. And she said, having that bolt hole for myself gave me that level of control. The residences were very close. Like they might have even been in the same.
I actually could give you a parallel illustration right there.
Yeah. And so they have that. And I look at that relationship. And I mean, from a subjective place, I'm like, oh, I wouldn't want to be in that relationship. But this woman said, there's some things here. The sex is good. We have some real common interests. It is nice knowing that we have that restaurant we like going and we share the bottle of wine and then this. But I have my gals night out on Saturdays. I have my card game on Tuesdays. And even when this person tries to encroach, she keeps her boundaries solid as hell. It again, obviously, everyone has different stories and different lives. And some narcissistic people are able to make those, you know, some enough small shifts. But the big shift that you're going to wake up and you're going to have ever this partner who's respectful, mutual in regard, oriented to your growth, well-regulated, that's not going to happen. What may happen is the micro tweaks may be enough for you to make a mediocre horse race of it. And that might feel like enough.
Well, and you
I
know,
can sign off on that.
One of the things that kind of, I'm not going to say drives me crazy, but it's like, it's a bit naive to say this. Many people just say, well, just go no contact. But sometimes it's just not possible. For example, it may be it's that person there at work and you're not going to quit your job, or it may be someone in your extended family, Aunt Maud, who just always runs the holiday times and you don't like her, but there she is. Sometimes you just can't go no contact. It may even be your life partner because you have kids together. And even if you're not living together, you still have some interaction based on that. And so one of the things that I emphasize when you're trying to break free is despite all of the externals that you wish that you could make different, you've got to focus heavily on the internals, your internals. How do I define myself, knowing full well what the narcissist is going to bring, knowing what the patterns are, just like you say, educating yourself, episode by episode, how would I be different, knowing what my history has taught me. And so that's where that client or that person, that survivor's insight is going to be so necessary. And they've got to hold on to the confidence that says, and I'm going to listen to myself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay attention to what my gut is telling me, and I'm going to follow through. And that's easier said than done, though, isn't it?
It is. You know, no contact's tricky, right? Because it was interesting. I was looking at some data that was gathered by one group, and when they were looking at things that worked for survivors of narcissistic abuse, and they had data on thousands of people. I mean, other than therapy and things like that, no contact was high on the list. So it is killing a mosquito with a hammer kind of thing. And it is not, it's in a hammer that's not available to many people. And I don't even know that it's good for some people who might say, if I go no contact, I may actually lose access to other elements of a social group that are quite supportive.
And that's, That can be valid at times.
Yeah. And I think that idea of no contact is, you know, somebody who's had a short-term dating relationship where there was no kids in shared residence or anything like that. Somebody who leaves a job, but certainly not someone who's in a job, as you said. To me, it's a rare intervention that can often, it can work, because when you think about it, it's like you've completely removed the toxin from the environment. And that's only when a person really can do an about face and get completely out of it. But beyond that, all of these workarounds, I reference Tina Swithin's work a lot. She's somebody with lived experience who was married, somebody who's more sort of malignant, narcissistic. And she coined the term yellow rock. And I really, really love her term because everyone wants
to explain that to us.
Yeah, because there's gray rocking, right? Traditional sort of technique. And gray rocking is that idea of be the gray rock. You still have contact, but it's a lot of yes, no, okay, one word responses that almost feel stonewally. What Tina says, and because a lot of Tina's work is around the area of co-parenting with a narcissist, she said yellow rock is about taking that very disengaged communication, but enlivening it with a little bit of color. Hey, thanks so much. Did you guys have a good weekend? Oh, wow. Is that a new shirt? Like you're talking about things that are honestly rather neutral. There's no getting into the mud with them. It's a very much a disengaged position. However, there's a little bit of people around you aren't looking around saying like, why is this person so?
In other words, refusing to just go into a downer kind of place. Yeah. Oh, I got you.
Yeah. And so that's about holding, you know, saying like, listen, I'm a warm, compassionate person. I don't need to engage with them, but I can certainly be, you know, the same way you might, if you go to the post office, you talk to the clerk warmly, you don't really know their life and you're not going to get right into it, but you can say, hey, how are you? I hope you're having a good day. That's you can be that. And I think that then you may feel more whole within yourself, especially if you're communication style is one that's been traditional. That's
sort of who you are anyway. Hey, I've got one last question here. And that is, okay, there are times when a person can say, you know, that person is no longer physically present with me, that narcissist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be that it's a parent that died or a sister that you no longer see or that friend that's no longer in your circle. And yet that narcissist message can still echo inside your mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so I guess the question is, how do we get beyond that so that the narcissist isn't just a ghost at the breakfast table, so to speak,
right,
that just keeps informing you about who you're supposed mm-hmm. to be?
I think first of all is to recognize those voices do last. And instead of saying, I'm going to eradicate this voice, which isn't always easy to do, especially if it was a primary developmental voice, like a parent, that their voice is going to be in there. And that awareness then means that when you are sort of talking yourself out of something or using your own self-devaluing language, you're actually able to create some distance, say, I see who's come to dinner, and say, yeah, you know, that's not working for me. We often, if you think of it as internal family systems work, and when they talk about the inner critic or even self-compassion work, that inner critic actually, and some of even these parts of these internalized voices, we grab up from some of them to keep ourselves safe, right? If I listen to the invalidating voice of the parent, then I'm not going to incur their rage. I'll know to stay back. And that you can say, oh, I see what's happening here. And then you can even sort of conjure up sort of this inner compassionate voice and saying, and I don't need to listen to that anymore. And I know that that's not true. I think some folks get really far down the road where they barely hear those voices anymore. I think under times of stress or disappointment, fatigue, loss, and grief, those voices come in as strong even decades later. Mm. But the idea, I think that what we often, in the get well quick TikTok, Instagram world we're in now, everybody wants, you know, that old film, right? Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Everybody wants a spotless mind. And there is no such thing. We are the culmination of our histories. And there's a lot of unwanted guests at that dinner table in our minds. And so the best you can do is put them in the cheap seats, bring the kinder voices sort of closer to the part of the table you're sitting at, recognizing that sometimes those voices will carry, and to give yourself permission to say, that voice belongs there. That is someone else's voice. Sit with it. That's what you're saying. Be with it for a minute, separate it out, and then recognize it's not yours. The big piece is separating those ancient voices from others, from our own sort of words that play in our head.
You bring our conversation full circle. You started by saying the narcissist is not a self-aware person, but you're saying if you and I are going to break free from that, well, that's the characteristic we need to hold on to and build upon, self-awareness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then all the planning that goes with it, which is why both you and I recommend folks, if you see this and you find it less than easy to break away, by all means, seek therapy. Get somebody who's an outside objective observer to help you sift it out and to gain enough wisdom about what's going on so that you can make your own decisions. Dr. Romney, I'm sitting here thinking you're just such a wealth of insight and encouragement. And so I so appreciate what you're sharing with us here today. Thank you for all the wonderful work that you do. And I'm so pleased to just be spoken from time to time in the same breath as you. How about that?
Well, I think we often are. And I'm so glad to see that there are I think it's great that there are different voices, because I think that the danger of there only being one voice in a space like this that's confusing is that, is this just one person's opinion? But yet that, you know, you and I are saying very similar things, and we, you know, and this is the first time we're actually meeting in person. We've been in communication, but, and I think that when people start seeing that the voices are sort of converging, that the things we're saying are converging, that it gives them permission to say, okay, this isn't me. And that obviously is a survivor's burden. There's got to be something wrong with me. And when they're hearing from multiple people that they're not. So I really, really appreciate, you know, the work you're doing, and I've been following it for years. So
goes thank both
you.
Ways. All right.
Thank you. Thank you,
Dr. Romney. Thank you so much for being part of the Surviving Narcissism podcast and video here. And I hope we're able to do this again. Okay.
I hope so too. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much. And Team Healthy, obviously, you know who Dr. Romney is. Make sure that you, if you don't, follow her on YouTube and all the other kind of things she has, and you'll be a better person for having done so. So once again, thank you, Dr. Romney, and I will see you, Team Healthy, next time around.
Sounds great. Thank you, Les.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. We are so glad to have you on Team Healthy.